This is Mike Thompson, recorded by Chris Alden Lee on the 26th of October 2011. Mike Thompson, Part 1.
I'm Michael Robert Alexander Thompson. I was born on the 28th of May 1942 at Acton, West London.
So how old are you now?
69, I think that makes me.
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
Yeah. What sort of education did you have?
I went to North Ealing Primary School. I lived in West Ealing. Went to North Ealing Primary School and then Ealing Grammar School, which sadly, of course, is no more. It was an excellent school in its day. Got ruined by government policy, you know. It was one of the ones that went by the wayside. So, very sad, I always thought that. It was an excellent school at the time.
College,
and then, well, that was one of the interesting things. One of the interesting things was you hear so much these days about kids and their divine right to go to university and all this kind of stuff. When I was at school, it was sort of assumed that that's what you were aiming for. And what I always remember was when you were doing your O levels and A levels, I've just sort of ricocheted through life. And I never really understood initially what the difference between O levels and A levels was. I'd stand in assembly in the mornings, and when I was lower down the school, and the headmaster would announce the fact that various people were registering for O levels and A levels, and they had to do it by 12 o'clock that morning or whatever it happened to be. And I thought, why does anybody want to do ordinary levels, you know? And that was the sort of the sort of culture that one was brought up in. And then I went on into the sixth form to do science. I did the standard mathematics and chemistry and physics, the basic three. All the time, the masters just assumed that you were going to go for university, and not just go to university. But I always remember the chemistry master saying to me, of course, what you'll really need to do is a PhD. So even before I left school, the assumption was that's where you were going. It's quite different these days.
What sort of culture were you brought up in then? What did your father do?
He was he worked for London Transport. So I came from a family that had never had anybody go to university or anything like that at all. As I say, I sort of ricocheted through life, and it just sort of seemed a good idea at the time. It's what you did. You went to school, and then you thought, well, you know, you've got two choices when you're 15 in those days. You left school, or you went on into the sixth form. And I went on into the sixth form. And then what do? You can then get another. You can then get a job, or you can go to university. And I went to university.
So, but you were bright enough to get to university.
Well, I went to university. To say I was bright enough is another thing, isn't it? I mean, that's somebody else's judgment, not mine. I passed the A levels all right, yes, put it that way.
Why geology?
I was getting a bit fed up with physics and chemistry. I really like physics and chemistry, but it was all becoming too mathematical, particularly physics. I mean, necessarily, but I don't know if what they teach in physics at school now, but physics, as I was taught, it was great fun because it was all the basics. It's, you know, things like Boyle's law and, you know, Hooke's law and all this sort of kind of stuff. It was rather more mechanical and stuff you could see, you know.
Brownian movement.
Even that was a bit esoteric, Brownian movement, actually. But when it started getting sort of... when you're getting down to atoms and particles and all this kind of stuff, I lost interest. And it's like chemistry, you know. Chemistry's fun when it makes pretty colours and horrible smells and explosions and things like that. I suppose one could have gone into pyrotechnics or something like that. But, you know, a lot of the fun seemed to have gone out of it. I could see that it wasn't becoming quite so interesting. And I suppose underneath it all, I'm more of a practical kind of person. I like to get my hands on things and do things and see a result sort of grow in front of me. I suppose that's just the kind of person I am, really.
You're giving me lots of reasons for not doing other things.
Exactly.
What was the reason for doing geology?
Well, it was sort of... OK, the reason for doing geology. Why did I do geology? I needed a change. I was interested in natural things, the natural world, I suppose. Always had been. And in fact, you know, right from a kid, you used to collect shells on the seaside holiday, of course. But also, I was fascinated by the different kinds of rocks you'd find on the beach, of course. Unless you go to Brighton, where it's all flint anyway, it's all the same. But if you go to places like Cornwall and that, there are an enormous range of pebbles from different rock types. And so there was that sort of interest, and that was it. It was just a whim, I suppose, in a way. Thought I was interested in fossils. Because again, that they were things that had once lived. So I took geology and I liked it. It was interesting. So interested. It grabbed me anyway.
Let me ask you about the other side then, because I was wondering what your first contact or knowledge or brush with the Antarctic ever was.
Oh, well, that's interesting, actually, because as a youth, I used to read lots of travel books, and particularly about places like South America and all that kind of thing. And I'd always had a hankering for that, but there was one thing which put me off a little bit, and that's all, you know, great hairy spiders and things like that, which I didn't really fancy. And that sort of put me off. Remember, I'm only reading these sort of heroic travelogues and things like that, you know, desperate deeds in the South American jungle and all that good stuff. But it was all quite interesting, except I've since learned there's loads of mosquitoes and all sorts of horrible things around, so I'm probably glad I didn't do that. I did read a little bit about the Antarctic as well, and decided that that was the last thing I ever wanted to do, was to go to the Antarctic, because it was cold and horrible and people died walking around and all this kind of stuff. And then, when we were in our final year at the University of Birmingham, which is where I went to, it just so happened that at Birmingham, that is where Bass geology was in those days. Now, I have to say that from a student point of view, they were completely faceless. Nobody knew who they were. And maybe we'll come to a bit more about that later. So there was this faceless unit housed somewhere within the department, except that it wasn't in a specific room or rooms, because they were just scattered around the building. So they were unidentifiable in a way. Anyway, one of my undergraduate colleagues said, oh, why don't we go and have a chat with Dr. Adey? He's the head of the, I think we probably still called it FIDS in those days. And it might be interesting to see, you know, what the job possibilities are. And I can't remember now, but there were three or four of us arranged, and we went along and talked to him about it. And I can't remember what the outcome of the discussion was or what we discussed or anything like that, but the net result was that of the three or four of us that went along, I was the only one that applied in the end, and all the others who'd sort of egged me on and sort of dragged me into this discussion, because I hadn't thought of doing it myself in the first instance, because I scarcely knew who FIDS and Bass were. But I was the one that ended up actually applying and getting a job.
But if you hated the Antarctic and everything about it, why did you apply?
Because I suppose it was peer pressure, I don't know. I mean, it just seemed like a good... I needed a job, for goodness sake, you know. I was quite interested in survey work. You see, the thing is that what you've got to realise is that in those days, the great thing, geology is a very practical subject. Well, there are laboratory-based sides of it, like, you know, radiometric dating and all that kind of stuff. But in those days, the glamour, if you like, or the was being a field geologist and going out to, and we still had colonies in those days, you know, going out to the colonies somewhere, most of them were in East Africa or somewhere like that, going out there and, you know, putting on your bush shorts and pith helmet or whatever it was, and beating your way across miles and miles of wilderness and mapping the geology to see what you could find. And that there was, I think, probably many geologists, young people in those days, saw that as a great thing to do, to go and map miles and miles of nowhere where no one had ever been before, or very few people had been before. So the first thing was to become a field geologist, you know, and not a laboratory geologist, to become a field geologist. Mm. Having said there were colonies, a lot of them were disappearing quite rapidly around that time. We're talking of early 60s, 62, 63. You know, a lot of these places are disappearing and becoming independent and going their own way and whatever. And the Antarctic Survey was one of the few left, actually, that offered the opportunity to do something completely original. You could go somewhere, and I did.
Virgin territory, you mean?
You could go somewhere where you knew that nobody had ever been before. You see, if you go to Africa, or say, if you went to somewhere like that, somebody would have been there. Okay, they might not have been a geologist, but somebody would have walked over it and but if you go to the Antarctic, you could go to places where you absolutely knew nobody had. They might have seen it from an aeroplane by the time, by the 1960s, a lot of it might have been seen by aeroplane or something like that. But you knew nobody'd ever actually been there and touched it. So you were the first person there. So it was quite.
So were there explorer genes in the Thompson family?
I don't know. I don't know what genetic heritage. I wouldn't know an explorer gene if I tripped over it.
Well, I mean, did he have uncles or
no? Suit? No, I'm just joking. But yeah, my father originally was in the Merchant Navy, and his father was a naval man. And I don't know about people before that, but yeah, there had been people who with a bit of a wanderlust, I suppose.
What did you make of Ray Ady?
A very curious fellow, actually. He, I don't know where to start this. He, as a young man, when he went to the Antarctic, he did a fantastic job. I don't think one should take that away from him. He showed a fantastic amount of dedication and perseverance and so on, and he actually did 3 years in the Antarctic because he got stuck for his final year. So he did 3 years in the Antarctic, kept up the momentum, and he, at the time, he had seen and mapped a larger area than anybody else who'd ever set foot on the place. The problem was that he was a South African, and this isn't a racist comment, it's to do with his geological upbringing. He was brought up on the geology of South Africa, which is completely different in many, many aspects to the geological makeup of the Antarctic Peninsula. Antarctica, if I can explain it in a simple... South Africa, in simple terms, is more of a stable continent with sort of bits of material added on around the edges where seas flooded in and so on, or in its interior it's got areas of terrestrial deposits and so on. Whereas the Antarctic Peninsula is part of the Pacific Rim. It's very, very active. It's had volcanoes popping off since time immemorial. There's lots of structural deformation and all sorts of things. It's very complicated. The more you get into it, you find out how complicated the geological story is. And what he tried to do was to use his South African training in a completely different geological environment and apply it to the Antarctic Peninsula. It might have worked if he'd gone to East Antarctica, which is very much like Africa in many respects, much more like Africa in many respects. The peninsula, however, is completely different. So he applied his sort of philosophy, if you like, to interpreting the geology of the peninsula. And he set up the first, what we call the stratigraphy. So that's the basic, the geological history. And, you know, you put it into, like, sort of packets or boxes, and you describe the story according to time and rock units and so on. And he then insisted that all his staff followed his basic pattern. And what that meant was that actually, that's the biggest criticism I would make of him, was that attitude kept the development of the British development of thought about the history, the geological history of the Antarctic Peninsula back. It just held it back by years and years and years. Whereas other people came in from the outside who knew a bit more about active margins, and they sort of ran away with it. And Bass got very much overtaken because it was forced to apply a false philosophy to the interpretation of the rocks. And it was quite staggering, actually, because when his basic story started to fall apart, or it could be demonstrated to fall apart, a lot of people had a feeling in their water, if you like, that things weren't quite right here. And, for example, one of the things was metamorphic rocks, rocks which have been changed through time by heat and pressure and all kinds of horrible things happening to them, were almost, in African terms, by definition, they're pre-Cambrian. In other words, they're pre-whatever, 550 million years old, and usually a lot more. We're talking of thousands, usually. And in the Antarctic, he goes and finds areas of strongly metamorphosed rocks. So these were pre-Cambrian because they're metamorphic. And then people started dating these rocks, and they came out at a fraction of the age, like 100 million years. Not 1,000 million years, they're coming out at 100 million years. And these weren't rogue dates. Everybody's getting the same sorts of numbers. And yet he still refused to admit that it wasn't Precambrian basement complex. And that's just one example. And it's just quite bizarre, really, that he just couldn't seem to move with the times. He got locked into this story, which he couldn't get out of. It was almost, you almost felt that it was, he'd be losing face if he suddenly...
Was that embarrassing for those who worked with him or under him?
It was incredibly frustrating. And I wasn't quite so touched by it because the rocks I was working on were almost out of his league, in the sense that my interests were in paleontology and fossils and so on, and he wasn't so bothered about those. And they were almost incontrovertible, you know, because you pick up this kind of fossil and that comes from rocks which are Cretaceous age, and you pick up these and they're Jurassic or whatever it happens to be. And provided you've got your identifications right, nobody can really gainsay you. When it comes to things like petrology and chemistry and radiometric dating, there's a lot more interpretation in there. So there's usually a little bit of wiggle room in there, but not that much. And the people who were working on what we call the hard rock areas, the areas of igneous rocks, the granites and the diorites and all this kind of stuff, and areas where there were metamorphic rocks, used to get terribly, terribly frustrated because they could see that the story they were told to tell was not the right story. Now, you see, I can see where he was coming from. There is an advantage. If you're a survey, there is an advantage in all singing from the same hymn sheet, as it were, and having a sort of, at least a basic understanding. So you're trying to interpret the rocks, and you all know roughly where you're going. But when it comes to the point when you realise you're all going the wrong way, it's time to call a halt. And there was a defining moment.
Which was?
And that was when we had a geological meeting, one of these periodical Antarctic geology and geophysics symposia, and it was held in Madison, Wisconsin, in I'll have to check the date, but in the...
Doesn't matter, we can look it up.
In the 1970s. It's sort of late 70s. I can't remember the date offhand. But a number of us dared... By that time, AD sort of moved a bit to the side, and a number of us dared to put up alternative explanations of what was going on. And I being one of them, and several of my other colleagues sort of writing, we presented papers saying we didn't think these things were quite right and so on. And then there were particularly people coming forward with radiometric dates and showing that the rocks really weren't the age they were meant to be. And AD was at this meeting, and it was interesting. He didn't sit in the audience. When we were giving our papers, he wasn't sitting in the audience. He was standing in the doorway with half an ear on the proceedings. And what he could have done is he could have said at the end of the session, he could have said, I think that was a really interesting selection of papers, and I think these young people are to be congratulated for the work they have done and the way they have moved the subject on, and et cetera, et cetera. You know, all the sort of fluffy words you can do. If he had stood up and said that, I think he would have gained in stature, because people would have said, well, here's a big man. You know, these guys have all got up and they've criticised his stratigraphy. But they have done it from a basis of hard work and diligence and whatever. And here's their boss, and he's prepared to say, I think they've done a good job and they've proved me wrong. But he didn't. He just slunk away and went for a cup of coffee or something. It was quite bizarre. It
raises two questions, then. One is, there was clearly nobody else at Bass at that time who could, in the higher up in the hierarchy, who could ask him or challenge his basic concepts.
Well, we all did, but there was, you're right, I mean, there was nobody, he was the chief, you see.
Yeah. So Fuchs would not know anything like enough about
it. He would have done, but he, although Fuchs was an earth scientist by training, I mean, he was got a degree in I'm not quite sure what you call it in Cambridge, but basically got a geology degree at Cambridge. I think he very quickly moved on. He did work which was more sort of more to do with landscape and geomorphology and stuff in East Africa. And then he moved on and became more of an expedition leader. Mm-hmm. So he quite quickly sort of went into that. And once he'd done that, you know, became administrator, because he became head of the British Antarctic Survey and things like that. So, no, there was no one else. And that's when... eventually they decided that there had to be somebody else, yes, put it that way.
And does that also then, with hindsight, explain that glass wall you talked about between the undergraduates, the university student undergraduate geologists, and the geologists working for Bass?
Well, there was a very...
In the same building.
Well, I have to say that for me, I was probably in the most difficult position of all at Birmingham, because here was I was an undergraduate from Birmingham, and so I owed my career, if you like, to the University of Birmingham. The course at Birmingham, I think, was excellent. They used to do all sorts of things you're not allowed to do today, but basically it was a course that actually made you into a field geologist. It was very practical. There was a lot of emphasis on field work and sort of field interpretation and all that kind of thing. And it was really enjoyable. So, yeah, I enjoyed my days at Birmingham. And in fact, one of the reasons I couldn't talk to you the other day is because I was meeting with some of my colleagues, my ex-colleagues from undergraduate days, and we all had a sort of get-together here, just, was it last week? So, yeah, a lot to be thankful for. But then we come to the Bass side. Then I sign up with British Antarctic Survey in Cambridge, And it's a completely different attitude because AD ran the thing like as though it was a public school. I mean, I was Thompson and my friends were Horn and Taylor and, you know, Blogs and whatever it happened to be. We were always referred to by our surnames. And he was always Dr. AD. He was never Ray AD. And I'll tell you a wee story about that. One of the most amazing things was after my second year at Stonington in the Antarctic, there's all these new FIDs coming in off the ship, help with a scow load of boxes of things that had to be unloaded. And while you're unloading the boxes, you're talking to all the new people that are coming down and they're going to replace you. And they're all going on about this amazing fella, this great guy called Ray on the ship. And I thought, who the heck is this? And so there are all these people who are carpenters and, you know, new field assistants and cooks and bottle washers and whatever. And they're all talking about this guy called Ray, who's the guy that I have to call Dr. AD, Sir Tug the Forelock. It was utterly bizarre, really. And yeah, could go on. How long have we got to talk about things like this?
As long as you like.
We could go on for ages.
Come back tomorrow.
we could talk for a lot about things like that. But it was a very peculiar situation. So I moved without physically moving, because I'm in the same building. I moved from being somebody who was very much part of the department, from somebody who was within that department, but not part of it. And it also came over, as I discovered in later years, after I'd been to the Antarctic and came back again, it came over through the people who had been, I'd been associated with as teaching staff and so on, and they're making comments to me like, well, when are you lot going to leave the building, you know, because they wanted us out and whatever. And we were never invited to become part of the department. I don't know what it was, and maybe it's something I will never, ever know the answer to. It could have been some kind of friction between AD and the department, because he was a bit like that. He could easily fall out with people. There may have been some friction there, but it's quite ridiculous. You have a department with students sitting inside it are a group of people who've done something very few people are ever going to have the opportunity of doing, that is going to a place like the Antarctic and seeing all these wonders and so on and coming back. And we were never, ever invited to take part in the affairs of the department, to give lectures or anything like that. It was utterly weird.
And is that down to AD's personality then?
Or
people's perceptions of it?
I really couldn't tell you. I mean, okay. That is my guess, that it must have had something to do with that. Because I can't think of any other reason why. The university took no advantage of having a unit like Bass sitting within it. It was most peculiar.
How about the relationship between the geology department at Bass in Birmingham and the other departments at Bass? And I know at this time they were scattered to the four winds.
That's right, yes.
Cambridge, London. So was there much connection? Was there any interaction between the different departments?
Very little. The only thing was that at Birmingham there was also botany. Bass Botany was at Birmingham as well, in a separate building. And there was some sort of link-up with them. But not a close link-up.
You'd have thought there might be some connection between geology in Birmingham and glaciology in Cambridge, for example. Do you remember
anything? No, because glaciology hardly existed in the early days. And what I mean by that is that most of any glaciology that there was run by AD at Birmingham.
Right.
We had people, he employed people to do sort of glaciological projects. They were seen as something a little curious, one has to say. I'm not sure. They may have had some link with Cambridge, and then sort of Charles Swithenbank came into the picture a bit later on, as he sort of, I think people had decided that it was quite inappropriate for AD to be running something like glaciology. Although, very curiously, AD was the chief... Was he the chief editor? He was certainly one of the editors of the Journal of Glaciology for many, many years. And so he used to run the Journal of Glaciology. He had a lot to do with that. In fact, Janet used to do the index for the Journal of Glaciology.
So it was a kind of fiefdom then, this...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Birmingham...
Yeah.
Bass department.
Yes. And you see, of course, there are all these other departments which are scattered to the four winds. You know, you've got, what was it, meteorology was up in Edinburgh, I think it was, and physics was down at the laboratories in Slough, Appleton Laboratories, atmospheric physics, and biology was in, initially it was Queen Mary College, London, and then it moved on. So we had, Bass was not a unit, it was all over the place.
What sort of facilities did you have as a young recruit to Bass? Were you given the most recently developed equipment, or was it...
You must be joking. Well, where do we start? If you think about, first of all, let's talk about, where shall we start? All right. Geological equipment. There was plenty of it, and the first thing one should say is that it was all... Here we are, we've got a man... Again, we come back to Dr. Ady. We always come back to Dr. Ady. Here we are. He occupies quite a senior position. He's the head of geology. He is also, as far as we could make out, second in line to Sir Vivian Fuchs. And a few weeks before we're due to head south, we're called into the laboratory to be issued with our field equipment. And who's doing the issuing? Dr. Ady. Not some minion, not some sort of secretary or something like that. Dr. Ady is issuing it personally himself. He got one of the lads to help him get it out. But the point is, he's doing the issuing. And he's laying out, you know, and you've got four hammers of this size and two hammers of this size. And it goes right down. This is the thing that blows my mind. It goes right down to mapping pen nibs, right? Mapping pen nibs, they're that big. Well, this isn't very good for radio, is it? They're an inch long and they're a little tiny little bit of metal. And you were issued with 14, not a slack handful. You know, he didn't just put his hand in the box and grab some and say, there you are, there's some mapping pen nibs. He counted them out, 14. It was incredible. And then there was this other wonderful thing. We were issued with string, miles of string, about four or five different balls of all different sizes and thicknesses and roughnesses and whatever. And it was a standing joke. And one of the lads once had the temerity to say, excuse me, Dr. Ady, what's all this string for? Because it was a bit of a puzzle as to what a geologist needed all this string for. And the comment he received back was, crikey, Horn, without string, you're lost. End of conversation. You know, there's no comeback on that one, is there? You can get really nitpicky and ask him about, you know, what knots you tie with this one and whatever. But, I mean, that was it. And so we were, having said that, the geological equipment was quite good. But we had all sorts of curious things as well. We were issued with a thing that's known as a blowpipe kit. And it was a wonderful little japanned black tin. And inside is a little blowpipe and a block of carbon and a whole load of different chemical powders. And what this was for determining if you had found any minerals of economic value, of potential economic value, I should say. And The curious thing about this is I think the only people who knew how to use this were graduates of the University of Birmingham. Because, in fact, we used to do a course, it was called Economic Mineralogy, And every Saturday morning we had to go in and learn how to use a blowpipe. Now, what that means is it's a cunning little trick, actually. We used to, in the lab, you'd use a Bunsen burner, and you have this little pipe with a right-angle bend and a very fine nozzle. And if you blow through it, it actually produces a very fine flame out of the side of the Bunsen burner, and it's incredibly hot. Somehow, don't ask me the physics behind this, but somehow it does increase the heat. And you used to you'd powder your rock up and mix it with different things, put it onto the block, the carbon block, and heat it up with your blowpipe. And it would often produce efflorescences of different colours, and that would tell you what the various minerals were. And as I say, I think the only people who understood that, I'm probably the only person that's ever worked for Bass who understood it, apart from Dr. Ady, actually.
Did he ever use it?
No. So we all had these wonderful little kits, because in those days you were allowed to use the economic word, and we were actually charged with keeping our eyes open for economic minerals.
I'll come to that later on.
Oh, well, that's
how did the better. Equipment, the quality of the equipment evolve? And did it evolve whilst Ady was still in charge?
No. Whilst he was there, it just remained the same. You know, there was a standard sheet, and as okay, you got your 14 mapping pen nibs and 3 1.5-pound geological
hammers. So there was some catching up to do eventually, was there?
Well, to be fair, to do field work as a geologist, you don't need much. You need a hammer and a few chisels and a notebook. I mean, and a compass and a clinometer to measure.
Thinking back in the lab.
Back in the lab, that's different, yeah. Back in the lab, we just used the facilities at Birmingham, you see.
Were they okay?
So, which were okay, yes. I mean, it was particularly for geochemistry. I suppose these days you'd look at it and regard it as quite primitive, but they were an up and coming geochemical department. They had some fairly bright boys there, actually. So, the geochemical equipment, yes, was fine. We were just getting into by the time I left, we eventually left Birmingham, we were just getting into the days of automated chemical analysis. In those days, you used to do it just like you would do at school, actually. You'd do titrations and all sorts of wonderful things to find out. You know, first of all, you'd have to dissolve your rock, crush it, and you dissolve it up in hydrofluoric acid and all sorts of nasties. Forget your health and safety, by the way. You just did it. You did all this. You dissolved it all up, and then you did various chemical tests to see what you got there, and then you would measure it, the relative proportions using titrations and so on. So that was a fairly standard sort of chemical technique. But then there were these new systems coming in whereby you use some kind of zapping system, and you'd zap it with rays and measure all the I can't think of the word now, but you the reaction of your powder to being hit with various rays and you instead of people used to do probably 15 or 20 chemical analyses in their writing up career, which was maybe 2 to 3 years after they got back from the Antarctic, and it would take them all that time to do it in the laboratory. And then we were moving into the days where we're using these automated machines, and you could do 15 in an afternoon. You know, it was a completely different ball game, and so people started producing chemical analyses by the zillion.
And roughly when did that modernisation take place?
Oh gosh, I can't remember. It sort of came in when we were still at Birmingham, so it's
before 76.
It's in the sort of late. It's in the early 70s that sort of stuff is moving in. XRF. So you'd be bombarding your. You'd make little. You'd crush the rock up to a powder, a very fine powder, and then you'd put it into a press and turn it into a little biscuit, put some resin in it, which was inert, and you put it under a pressure and a considerable pressure, and it would turn out like this very fine biscuit. And then that was slotted into your X-ray diffraction machine. and zapped with X-rays, and then the different minerals would react in different ways, and X-rays come off at different angles and velocities and goodness knows what else. And from that, you could work out the proportions of different elements present.
When he was issuing you, here you are, about to go south for the first time, he was issuing you with all this strange equipment. Was there also a brown envelope issued at that time?
Somebody's been telling tales, haven't they?
Well, I have heard about these brown envelopes.
Yeah, well, my story is probably one of the longer ones. Go on. So sit back and relax.
Thank you.
When I told this story at Bass, people were literally open-mouthed. They couldn't believe it, particularly people from other divisions, because they never knew this was going on. But we were treated, well, as I say, we were treated like public schoolboys. Thompson. Yes, Dr. Ady. And we were given, before we went south, we were given sealed orders as to what we should be doing. And theoretically, these were to be given to us, certainly at least before we got on the ship at Southampton to sail south. And in fact, there was no conceivable reason as to why they shouldn't have been handed over in the laboratory at Birmingham. And so we started before we finally packed up and left to go down to the ship. Dr. Ady, have you got our sealed orders? I've been far too busy. You'll get them later, don't worry. Of course, we didn't. We get to Southampton, and we got all our gear loaded on the ship, and there's the sort of final blast on the hooter, which means, you know, all visitors off the ship and all those coming aboard, come aboard now. And I'm at the foot, I remember this in the moment, I was at the foot of the gangplank saying my last farewell to Dr. Ady. And I said, excuse me, Dr. Ady, do you have our sealed orders, please? I've been far too busy. Don't worry, you'll get them in Stanley. Right? So, end of story, you know. So, I get on the ship, and 3 weeks to Montevideo, and a couple of days in Montevideo, and then best part of another week down to the Falklands. So, a month later or so, we arrive in the Falkland Islands, and there's mail waiting for us. So there's a couple of letters from mother and, you know, and maybe from auntie and granny and whatever, that kind of stuff. No letter from Birmingham. No sealed orders. So here we are. And then you're in Stanley for a week or so. And here we are heading south for the Antarctic. And we still don't know what we're supposed to be doing. And to cut a long story short, what happened was, our entry to the Antarctic was somewhat unusual because it was a really bad ice year. And we managed to relieve the two most northern bases at Cygni and the South Orkney Islands, and eventually Deception Island in the South Shetland Islands. And then we headed a little bit further south. We managed just to get into the Argentine Islands, and we came out of there and we got stuck. And we then spent, I think it was nearly 2 months, just stuck in the ice, doing nothing. Now, we were supposed to be receiving some bodies from who'd come down behind us, and they were a doctor and a vet, and a Russian exchange geologist, and they had, I don't know why they were treated specially, because the rest of us weren't, they had flown to Montevideo, and they'd been picked up by what was then HMS Protector, which was the naval, it was called the Ice Patrol Ship. Hmm. Well, the only ice patrolling it did, because it was an old net layer or something like that, it had plating about, I don't know, thickness of a sheet of paper or something like that. And so its ice patrolling consisted of making sure it didn't go anywhere near the ice. It would patrol until it could see the ice and make sure it stood well clear. Didn't ever enter the ice. So it was known as the Grey Ghost because nobody ever saw it. It wasn't red like the modern ships I was painting grey, like a standard naval ship. Anyway, one day we were informed that the Protector was nearby. Now, we're stuck in the ice. It was a pretty foggy day. You couldn't see very far anyway. And everybody's out there with the binoculars. You couldn't see a thing anywhere. And then suddenly there's the waka 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 of a helicopter coming in. And we still couldn't see where it had come from, but this helicopter had clearly come from HMS Protector, and it's coming in, and it landed on a big ice floe nearby, and it brought the vet and the doctor and the Russian exchange scientist and a whole pile of clatch and some mail, including the sealed orders at last.
And were they worth waiting for?
Well, you've obviously been primed again, because my sealed orders were to map the east coast of the Antarctic Peninsula, south of 70 degrees south. And that couldn't possibly be right, because the east coast of the Antarctic Peninsula was, in those days, was incredibly difficult to get at. And B, it was all the wrong rocks, because it was known that I was a paleontologist, and in fact I'd been all along I'd been given the impression that I was going to be looking at some fossiliferous rocks, and it's all full of horrible things like gabbros and granites and all sorts of and metamorphic rocks and things like that, and I knew it wasn't for me. And Antarctic Peninsula was actually a misprint for Alexander Island. And I assumed that it was a misprint, and that really I was meant to map the east coast of Alexander Island. So that's what I did. Nobody ever complained. But that's not what my orders said. It was just weird, weird, absolutely weird.
What I find odd is that if you talk to scientists in other faculties of BASS at that time, they were usually asked, what would you like to do when you go down south, and would you like to devise your own programme?
At least
there was discussion between the professors and the new FIDs, the FID scientists, as to what they might do.
Mm.
Whereas in your case, it was all there was. I presume there was no consultation with you beforehand as to what you would do when you got there.
No, I mean, it was a bit curious in the sense that to keep us amused, I suppose, in that the training at Birmingham was amazing. We all assembled on myself and four other colleagues who were all to go down together. We all met at the appointed hour in the petrology lab, and Dr. Adie comes in and sort of said a few pleasantries and how we got to work very, very hard and all this kind of stuff. And he disappeared. So we're left chatting quietly among ourselves. And then he came back actually buckling at the knees, carrying vast quantities of tomes of Scott and Shackleton and all this kind of stuff, dumped those on the table and said, you've got to read these very, very carefully, you know, very carefully. And then he disappeared and he came back with another pile. And he did this several times. And I mean, if you asked anybody to do that these days, they wouldn't do it. But we came from a different era, you know, that's what we were told to do, so we did, and we read all
that. So was reading your soil preparation for going south?
It seemed like it for the first few weeks, but eventually we did more practical stuff, and we were given sort of Antarctic rocks and samples to look at. Mm. And I was given a whole load of fossils, and that's one thing that made me feel that actually I was destined to do some paleontology in the Antarctic, whereas all my colleagues were given igneous rocks and metamorphic rocks and whatever to look at. But there was no purpose behind it. It wasn't, look at these rocks and answer these questions. It was just, you know, have a look at these things.
Were you aware of any kind of an overarching strategy of determining what the geology of the Antarctic was? Did you know where your little cog fitted into the...
Well, no, we were really there to... the way I saw it, we were there to map. I mean, don't get me wrong, nobody was complaining about it, in the sense, because that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to just go out and find out what was there. So we were all of us were going to places that nobody had ever been to before. So it was go there and find out what it is, except that it was known that the sort of broad geology was known.
Mm.
Of course, there could have always been surprises, but the broad geology was known. And although every outcrop hadn't been mapped and so on, it would have been a real surprise if you'd gone to this place and found fossils and gone to this place and found a steaming great granite or something, or a volcano or something, because they didn't occur in those sort of places. So we were there to really go and find out what was there. So it was really groundbreaking stuff in that sense. But no, we weren't sort of challenged to go and work and find out the story, because, as you know, when we got back, we were told to describe what we had found in terms of the predetermined stratigraphy. So regardless of... And this was the difficulty, because people would go into the field, they'd look at their one bit, and they'd work out the order of the rocks and the order of events and all this kind of thing, and say, well, that's what happened in this area. And then be told, well, I'm sorry about that, but you've got to describe it in terms of the stratigraphy. So it was really, really very curious.
I heard somewhere else that the next year's geologists joining the department in Bass Department in Birmingham didn't really have any access to previous year's geologists. Do you remember that? Was there a wall between the two? The different
a bit
years?
Of a bit of a wall, although in the sense that there was no official encouragement to work together. So the new people came in and they were given these great piles of books and to read and all that kind of thing. And so AD took a very strong hand on that, and he told these people what to do. But of course it was inevitable that what happened was the first thing you do is, having read through the first 35 pages of Scott or something, you need a bit of a brain clearer. And so we went to Coffee or Smoko with the other FIDs. So one of the other chaps would come down and collect us and say, oh, by the way, my name's Joe Soap. You know, I was at Hope Bay, or I was here, there, or wherever. We're all going to Coffee. Would you like to come across? And then once that was done, of course, it became standard. So you used to, socially, we met these people, yes.
Right.
But there was no academic interaction. Well, at least no official academic interaction.
Is that part of AD's strategy again?
Well, I think it must have been. You know, he certainly didn't encourage it. Mm. Sounds awful, doesn't it, as I'm really putting the boot in. But, I mean, it really was like that.
You're not saying things that other people haven't said.
Yeah.
So tell me about the revolution when he went, then.
Well, that was all very sad, in a way, because of... Perhaps it goes back to his sort of character, in the sense that, as I've said, he'd worked out the geology, he'd done all the fundamental work, this was the story, and when it all started to fall apart, he didn't have... there was that incident at Madison, when he could have been reborn, in a way, in that he could have said, well, it's fantastic what these chaps have done, and they've really turned the story on its head. He was a man who was always very set in his ways, you see. So what happened was, when Fuchs retired, there was a competition for director. And among the candidates, I don't know who they all were, maybe they were only these two. There was Dick Laws, who was the head of biology, and there was Ray Ady, who was head of geology. Now, as I said before, Ray Ady had been the sort of acknowledged second in command to Fuchs. But the choice for the new director was Dick Laws. And the consolation prize, I suppose, was that Dr. Ady was made deputy director, and they drafted in Charles Swithenbank as head of earth sciences. And because he was a glaciologist, it wasn't long after that that there was a need for a senior geologist. They felt that in the past, Ady had masterminded glaciology, about which he probably knew not a great deal. It was inappropriate for Charles Swithenbank, albeit head of Earth Sciences, to be... Well, he just wasn't in a position to formulate new geological programs and that sort of thing. So by that time, AD was completely sidelined. And as a little aside there, it's quite interesting. So AD took this very badly, very badly. And not long afterwards, we finally got our headquarters and we all moved to Cambridge. And then AD had absolutely nothing to do with geology at all. He never came round. There was a sort of geological corridor, which was on the opposite side of the building. He never came round to have a chat and say, how's things are going? He wasn't that kind of a person. He was deputy director. He was nothing more to do with geology, and he stayed up in his little Eagles Eyrie in the office next to Dick Laws. There was one occasion, which was... Well, we hadn't really unpacked, I suppose. I'm sitting in my new office, sort of feeling the desk and sort of looking around, getting used to the new layout of the furniture. And AD comes in and he's standing in the doorway of my new office. And his toes were on the metal strip between... He's standing on the lino in the corridor with his toes on the metal strip that demarcated the lino from the carpet in my room. That is as far as he got. He didn't even come in the room. It's quite incredible. You know, you thought he'd just sort of breeze in and say, well, how is it? Have you got yourself sorted out yet? And all this kind of stuff. He wasn't like
that. So you become what at this point?
I was then chief geologist.
Yeah, okay. We are leaping about. Yes. It doesn't matter, it's fine. But I'd like to go back a bit now to your first trip south. And you, of course, you sailed, because in those days people did.
Yeah.
Were there advantages in going down by sea? Or was it all wasted time?
That depends on your outlook. I mean, at the time, I never thought I certainly didn't think of it as wasted. I mean, it's what you did. That's what we were told in our illicit meetings with the older FIDs. You know, that's what you did. You got on the ship and you sailed this, and it was all quite a great adventure. The thing is that in those days, it was completely different. I mean, you had very little contact with the outside world once you were down south. So what you're doing actually is you're sailing south with all the people you're going to be living with for the next few years, and getting to know people, whereas now you're parachuted in virtually, and okay, you may know some of them, but you don't know all of them, and suddenly you're parachuted in and there are all these hairy diesel mechs and other people that you've never met in your life before, whereas you met the hairy diesel mechs on the ship and you got to know them and so on. So it was a good bedding. I think it was a good bedding in process, actually. You also, of course, quite quickly work out who are the oddballs, and there always were oddballs, so you pick those out. But it was a good bedding in process. And I think it probably stood for what we were doing. You're going to end up on a base for a year or in most cases, 2 years with these people. It was good, actually. It was probably the best way to do it. And I don't regret it in any way. And I always used to get... And then what happened is there was a turning of the tables. You get all these really important new graduates. I can't waste my time sitting on a ship. I should be doing science and all this good stuff, you know. And then they all sort of pleaded and bleated until... air facilities started opening up because you could fly to South America, and then there was the air link with the Falkland Islands and so on, so you could speed up the whole process. And these important new graduates had to do this. It wasn't their job to be wasting their time on a ship with plumbers and all this kind of thing. And I'm sorry, I just have no affinity for that kind of behaviour. I thought it was good on the ship, actually, and... got to know a lot of people and struck up lots of friendships before you even got to the Antarctic.
From your various... When you became chief geologist, What were you drawing upon from your time in the Antarctic, which started to shape the way you ran your department, or you ran your business, so to speak? In other words, in those early visits down to the Antarctic before was sidelined, what were you picking up from those experiences, which then became really useful to you when you had to move into management?
Well, I think things were slowly changing because we were moving into we had moved into the era where we were a bit allowed to think for ourselves, and you could, well. The whole peninsula actually needed remapping with new eyes. Because of this ridiculous straitjacket that we had been working in. Not that we couldn't do that. I mean, nobody's going to give you the money to do that kind of thing. But really, the fundamental position is that is what was required. A completely new look at the whole thing, using... sort of modern theories and so on.
So your job really was to effect this completely fresh approach.
Well, I hope so. I hope that's what I was doing. And I don't know what other people have said about me, but one thing I would like to be thought of as somebody who allowed his staff to think what they wanted to think, which is something that we hadn't been allowed to before. So even if somebody came up with some fairly hairy ideas, you know, I might say something and say, well, I'm not quite sure that this is right. But on the other hand, I hope I would have never have been so dog in a manger, I would have stopped it. You know, so if somebody did want to express opinion which was against the rules, as it were, I wouldn't stop them.
So can you remember how you went about clearing out the old culture and opening the doors for a newer one?
Well, I don't know, as it was done sort of... well, first of all, we were allowed to employ our own staff, because until then, all interviews for geological staff were done by AD.
Right.
So I really can't remember... I'm much better with geological timescales than human timescales, I have to admit. And, you know, one day's the same as the next to me, and I can't remember all the details, you know, the sort of chronological details. But in general terms, what we were doing is moving into an era where I was able to employ my own staff. And... okay, we had to formulate programs for them because they wouldn't know anything about the Antarctic. But, you know, give them a project to do and let them get stuck into it. Sort of, I suppose, encourage people to talk to other people and sort of... I hope they had a much freer reign than we ever did.
You moved up to become Division head.
Yeah, they just keep changing the name. You know, change the name.
Did you feel like promotion?
No, it's just change. Well, to division head. Yeah, because they split glaciology off, didn't they? That's right.
What sort of things were you dealing with as division head? What were the problems that were turning up on your desk?
Oh God, I don't know. Don't know. I'll have to think about that one.
I'll come back to that later.
Yes.
Again, were you moving things forward, I suppose, from having repaired the damage that you saw that was you inherited?
Yeah, well, there were certain things we did. For example, I noticed in Jo's notes, she was one of the things you're supposed to, or one of the potential discussions was the institution of 5-year programs and things like that. Without being rude, I'd say that's hogwash, because this 5-year program was a thing that NERC thought they were imposing on us, because when we moved into NERC, Natural Environment Research Council, you know, they wanted to take charge and sort us lot out and all that kind of thing. In geology, at least, we had had 5-year programs for years. We'd already, you know, once we got a bit of freedom, I used to sit down with others of the more senior geologists, and we'd sit down and say, what are the problems? And we had an allocation of staff. So what we could do is we could sit down and work out that we got A, B, C and D, and B and C were going to be leaving in 2 years, because the people were on 5-year contracts, you know. Well, we used to count them as 5 years anyway. So B and C are leaving in 3 years' time, and D's leaving in 4 years' time. And so from that, you knew when you have spaces freed up and you could employ new people. And then people used to say, well, this is a problem we need to attack. We need to go to this area and solve this problem. And somebody else, well, I want to go there and solve that. And so we used to sit down, and we had a 5-year program of our own within geology, which allocate over, it was what you might call more of a 5-year forward look, because we used to do it every year and move it up a notch, you see. Knock the last year off and then move on to the next one. So we had a 5-year, an unofficial, if you like, 5-year program. So we knew where we were going. And I have to say that for all the huffing and puffing from our people in NERC and about their wonderful 5-year programs, there are very few things that ever dropped off our 5-year program. We might not have done them in the same order because things might have changed. You know, person X didn't leave, still had a bit more work to do, and didn't leave in the year you thought they were going to go, and so it was a year before you could replace them or something like that. So those little things used to happen, and also it would depend on logistics, because if you wanted to go somewhere odd, a ship, for example, might not be free, and for not next year, but it would become available. It had a more open program in 2 years' time, or things like that. So you could then, we adjusted the 5-year program, but I think I can honestly say that we used to get it done, and that was before anybody told us what to do. And I always resented. It's quite a lot of resentment around. I always resented the way these people came in from the outside, told us what to do, when in fact we had been doing it all the time.
And how did you adjust? Because you went in as a scientist, as a field geologist, and suddenly here you are managing human beings, resources, departments, budgets. Was it a natural, an easy step for you to take?
Well, half and half, really. I'm the sort of person that can organise things in some detail, you know, sort out programmes and things and work out where you've got to be by when and how many meat bars you need and how many hammers and, you know, I can work all that kind of stuff out. But, you know, there are other issues, I suppose. There must have been, you know, personnel issues and so on. I mean, inevitably you get staff, however hard you try, you just cannot get on with. Whatever they do, they get up your nose. And unfortunately, you chose them. You know, and you think, why did I ever pick that guy?
But you adapted to this different role.
Probably half-heartedly, yes. I mean, I would never, ever regard myself as a serious administrator. I don't know what other people think of me, but I mean, I guess it was an uneasy relationship. And just to sort of put that in some context, we're talking about what I do now. And as an enthusiast, I helped to run this Victorian sawmill. And we rely heavily on volunteers to do that. Mm. I don't get paid anything, but I am a director at the mill.
Yeah.
So I have managerial responsibility. And we have very little money, so we rely entirely on volunteers, so we have to get all these volunteers in to help. And we ask them to do certain things. But of course, the more you get them to do, the more they want to become involved, the more they want to know, the more you have to feed them. And I'm beginning to think, hang about, I thought I'd left this all behind. Because this is what used to happen at Bass. It's always the problem. And with people, the more you involve them, the more they crave for.
The more enthusiastic they become.
To some extent, there are also the barrack room lawyers hidden among them, you know, who want various things because it's their right. And so, yeah, we've sort of come full circle on that one. And it's something that I don't really like, actually. I'm the sort of person, I suppose it was the way, something to do with the generation, you're brought up and the headmaster says do this and you do it. You might not like it, but you don't question it. You do it because that's what you've been asked or told to do. And I can live happily with that. But people these days, they have to question absolutely everything. And I just find it very difficult to get on with, really.
Let's take a break from the questioning then, shall we?